From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Back in 2016, Chris Harlan Dunaway was between two worlds.
Well, I just finished my first year in journalism school, and I had been a semi-pro bike racer for 6 years.
Chris was in his mid-20s. He was thinking more seriously about his career in journalism, but he also wasn't quite ready to give up on bike racing.
I had always dreamt of racing my bike in Europe because that's the heartland, and I decided, well, this is my opportunity.
So in the middle of grad school, Chris made a go of it. He flew to Belgium and got a little apartment and began testing himself against the elite riders in a place where bicycle racing is a really big deal. It's full of traditions and idiosyncrasies, like the Rodania car that drives ahead of Belgian bike races, blaring an ad for Rodania watches.
It's the ice cream truck of Belgium. Everyone hears that call, and they hear the Rodania, and they know there's a bike race happening just out their front door. And so they gather along the sides with their paper cones of fries and beer and watch the racing.
So there's Chris doing this thing he's always dreamed of doing. And he's performing really well, placing in races and just training all the time. Taking these long rides on narrow ribbons of road through the Ardennes, a region stretching from Belgium through France, Luxembourg, and into Germany.
I would go on these rides and I would pass through the spruce forests. It's so peaceful, and like I couldn't help thinking whenever I sort of encountered these moments out there that this is also this place where there's this unbelievable carnage happened there during World War II.
And this is where Chris's curiosity and love for journalism began creeping back into focus. The Ardennes Forest saw some of the fiercest fighting of World War II. In December 1944, Germany launched a surprise attack that would become one of its last major offensives. Today, we know it as the Battle of the Bulge, and Chris wanted to know what it was really like.
And so I became obsessed with finding the oldest people in the villages nearby, people who would be willing to talk to me and tell me about what they saw during World War II. I figured, what better way to understand what it was like than to talk to people who are still alive and who can still tell stories about what happened?
After hearing some of those stories, he began picking up on whispers of an incident he knew almost nothing about, one that's received little attention in the history books.
We see the men and women who fought in World War II as the greatest generation for beating Hitler. They did this amazing thing. They saved the world.
And while all of that is true, Chris has spent the last 2 years investigating whether that's all they did.
Maybe bad things had happened that no one is really willing to talk about.
We're spending the whole show today looking into a single event, an American war crime during World War II, the massacre at Chinon, and why nearly three quarters of a century later, most people don't know about it. And those who do still don't seem to want to talk about it. Chris takes the story from here.
There are always soldiers who don't talk or can't talk about what they went through. And often, it's not until they're old, looking back on their lives, that some of these stories about war finally start to come out. I searched a long time for someone who knew about Chinon. There aren't many people who really know what happened there, let alone saw what happened there with their own eyes.
The one thing that's missing is my combat infantry badge, which got lost in our attic. That's the thing I was proudest of.
Frank Hartzell's 93, lives outside Philadelphia. These days, sweaters over collared shirts are kind of his thing. 75 years ago, though, he didn't have the luxury of a signature look. It was just combat uniforms, like the one we're digging out of the closet in his study. It's got the 11th Armored Division patch right on the shoulder.
Here is a...
Oh, wow, yeah, there's the patch, the Thunderbolt patch.
Yeah.
So, did you wear this in the Ardennes?
No. Well, yeah, I guess we did. Yeah, this is what we wore.
After the war, Frank went to Drexel and MIT. He worked his entire civilian life as a structural engineer, making sure buildings were safe. He's sharp, still talks with the precision of an engineer. I saw a picture of him back before the war. at basic training in the California desert, standing at attention, rifle resting against his shoulder, a little smirk on his face. He had the same round boyish cheeks he has today.
I got my notice when I was 18 that I was drafted. Once I graduated from high school, I was soon after, next week or so, called to take a physical, passed a physical, and was inducted into the service. And I guess it was July.
Because he had good grades, he was fast-tracked for an officer training program in Washington State. But after a few months, the Army disbanded the program because they didn't need leadership. Hitler still had a firm grip on Europe. And Frank says what the Army really needed was cannon fodder. So Frank sat down with his two buddies, Paul Gentile and Bob Fordyce.
We'd made this pact among us that we'd go to visit the parents of if anything had happened to one of us.
Before shipping out, Frank was allowed to return home to Wallingford, Connecticut, one last time. On his first morning home, he came downstairs, and there was his mom, standing in the kitchen.
She had the radio on. She said the Allies have landed in France.
This is Robert St. John in the NBC newsroom in New York. Ladies and gentlemen, we may be approaching a fateful hour. All night long, bulletins have been pouring in from Berlin claiming that D-Day is here, claiming that the invasion of Western Europe has begun.
After D-Day happened, the U.S. began shipping as many men as it could, as fast as it could, across the Atlantic. Frank and his best friend Bob took a picture together in London, below the Big Ben clock tower. They're standing shoulder to shoulder, smiling, wearing those army envelope hats tilted off to one side. After a couple weeks living in Quonset huts, they crossed the English Channel to France.
We were actually on the channel on December 16th when the Battle of the Bulge started.
The Battle of the Bulge began at 5:30 a.m. The pre-dawn sky lit up with artillery fire. For the next 3 weeks, the entire war hung in the balance. It was Hitler's secret last-ditch counterattack against the Allies in the Ardennes Forest in Belgium.
Under cloudy skies and close-hanging ground mists that defied aerial observation, the very much alive German army gathered its forces in the forest aisles to strike one strong, decisive blow at the American army.
Hitler's favorite tank commander, Joachim Peiper, led the charge, promising, in his words, to break the resistance by terror. In the opening hours of battle, he shocked American troops near the Belgian town of Malmedy.
Malmedy, scene of an appalling crime. Here men of the United States 30th Division uncover the frozen bodies of American soldiers who, after surrendering, were murdered by their German captors.
The story was gruesome. On the first day of the Battle of the Bulge, American soldiers ran straight into German tanks by accident. They surrendered. German soldiers corralled the American POWs in a muddy field beside a crossroads and shot them. Some Americans played dead. They listened as the Germans walked among the bodies, shooting anyone who looked alive. In all, 84 American prisoners were killed. It was called the Malmedy Massacre. News of the atrocity was spreading just as Frank and his battalion were piling into armored trucks called half-tracks, heading straight towards those same German forces that massacred fellow GIs. To dodge German observation planes, Frank's convoy advanced in the dark.
We drove all night, no lights, very slowly. You can't even see. I mean, they would have the armor down this little slit they'd look out of, and it was really something.
It was so cold that equipment froze to the ground. Both sides were bogging down, fighting from village to village. This would be Frank's first experience in combat, trying to take control of a Belgian town named Chinon.
The next morning, then, we made this attack on Chinon. The sky was just leaden, snow-covered field. That's what it was. there's a machine gun firing at us. But we were going up this field, and we were under some fire. Anyway, we finally got up, and we took that ridge.
The ridge looked out over scattered Belgian farmhouses, a church steeple. Another group of Americans tried and failed to take the town the day before. Frank remembers looking down on their burning tanks. And there's another thing he remembers, something 8 veterans from the 11th Armored say is true, that there was an order to take no prisoners.
That we went down into town, and then we were told to pull back. I do remember digging in the foxhole along the top of that ridge.
They were going to try again the next day. Frank was with his buddy, Bob. It was New Year's Eve, 1945.
It's twilight, I guess. There's shooting going. There's somewhere sporadic artillery coming in, and we were digging, and it was so hard to dig in that frozen ground. And Bob Fordyce, who I dug with, he was a hard worker, and he'd been digging and working hard. And he said, Frank, you want to dig for a while?
Frank got in the foxhole. He hacked at the dirt. It was like rock. Then they heard artillery rumble in the distance. German shells started whistling down all around them.
And I hadn't been in there digging for 2 minutes before some 88 fire came in, and the hole was just shallow enough. I was lying down. When the fire comes in, you lie down. He was lying down on the outside where I'd been. And this piece of shrapnel, I guess, I heard it or felt it hit the top of my helmet, just a little teeny down the top of my helmet. And I remember saying, boy, Bob, that was close. And I looked up, and it had taken the top of his head off. And I remember shouting over to Tom Hickok, who was our squad leader. I said, Bob's dead. I guess we spent the rest of the night there. I don't know if his body stayed there all night or not. Well, I lost my two best friends in the first 2 days.
In the morning, Frank climbed out of his foxhole. His battalion gathered along the ridgeline. Behind them, U.S. artillery started shelling the town of Chinon, trying to soften up the Germans before the attack. They waited. The guns went quiet. Then they charged down into town. Machine gun fire snapped through the air as the GIs ran through the snow. The Germans were ready. What do you remember seeing around you as you moved into town?
What did I see? Just the houses, and which had been pretty well demolished by the bombs dropped on the town. Dead bodies or people have been wounded. Chaotic combat is when you're actually in it. It's very chaotic, yeah.
The GIs pushed through the village, starting at one end, hoping to reach the other. They zigzagged, taking cover from the German guns wherever they could. The Americans couldn't figure out where one of the machine guns was shooting from. Then they spotted the source, the basement window of a farmhouse.
I remember I being near that farmhouse, just outside this high stone wall, probably 2 or 3 yards from it.
Two of Frank's buddies hopped the wall, lobbing grenades at the open upstairs windows. Their aim was bad. The grenades bounced off the side of the farmhouse. One of the men dove into the doorway of the house to dodge the explosion. The other guy was shot while trying to make it back to that stone wall, the same one where Frank was taking cover next to one of their sergeants, a guy named Ed Fraley.
Ed Fraley, I remember. And he said, my stomach hurts. So I looked and pulled his shirt up, and I couldn't see anything in his stomach at all. Then I turned him over, and there was a little hole in his back, and he died.
That high-caliber German machine gun wouldn't stop. Behind Frank, a bunch of these Shermans, these quick, scrappy American tanks, rolled into town. One of them fired its cannon at the farmhouse. The smoke cleared, and the machine gun went quiet. The side of the farmhouse was cratered. There was nothing the Germans could do but surrender.
They'd stopped shooting because we'd surrounded them.
By this point, Frank dashed off to continue fighting throughout town. He and the other Americans spread out, surrounding each farmhouse as they went. Eventually, the Germans began surrendering en masse.
I just remember filing out, yeah. long overcoats, and they were pretty bedraggled as we were. They'd been attacking for 2 weeks and living in the cold as we had, so they were probably just about as unshaven and as dirty as we were. Worse, because they'd been around longer.
Under the rules of land warfare in the U.S., the Germans were prisoners of war. They should have been taken to a collection point behind the front lines and transferred to a prison camp. Instead, the German soldiers were stripped of their weapons and herded to an empty field where they stood in the snow.
Things quieted down. I remember we got orders, take no prisoners. And that's when, I think it was that afternoon that the I don't know if how they were shot. When I walked past a field on the left where there were these dead bodies, I knew what they were. I knew they were dead Germans, and that's about all I can say.
Frank says he wasn't there in the field when the German prisoners were gunned down. He says that he had no part in it. What amount of blame by saying, take no prisoners, do you think they deserve?
The person who issued the original order had a lot of responsibility. I couldn't pull a trigger on just men standing unarmed men. And most people, I don't think, could do that. So I'd say whoever pulled the trigger has most responsibility.
Back in the States, the New York Times landed on people's doorsteps. On page 3, there were two stories. On the left side of the broadsheet, an article confirmed the Malmedy massacre by Joachim Peiper's German troops weeks earlier. On the right side of the same page, the other headline read, Strike on 10 Mile Front. It told the story of General Patton's lightning assault that knocked the Germans off balance. It noted back and forth attacks and counterattacks in a town called Chinon. But nothing else. That wasn't the whole story. And I couldn't get the whole story from Frank because he only knows so much.
But there is someone else who knows more, a man so obsessed with the massacre at Chinon that he bought a house on top of the ridge, right next to the foxhole where Frank lost his best friend, Bob.
The people doesn't know that every day, in every unit, German and American, it was a war crime every day, every day.
That's next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Support for Reveal comes from Home Advisor, matching homeowners with home improvement professionals for a variety of home projects, from minor repairs to major remodels. Homeowners can read reviews of local pros and book appointments online at homeadvisor.com.